The Royal National Institute for the Blind in the United Kingdom takes a proactive stance on web accessibility. They have a person who's dedicated to promoting web accessibility throughout the United Kingdom. Julie Howard is that person, and I asked her earlier this week to tell me a little bit about the Royal National Institute for the Blind's digital access campaign.
RNIB has been interested in the internet for several years. In fact, we set up our own website way back in 1995, which was really early days for the internet. Our interest is really because blind people are using the internet and finding it so useful, and it's a great way to get more information out to people who can't read print, for example. So for a long time we've taken interest in using the internet to give people better access to our own information, and it's a very natural follow-on from that, that we're concerned that other people are putting information onto the web in a way that blind people can use.
In some countries it might be considered a little different that an agency providing services to the blind is so actively involved in advocating for the needs of blind people as well. Is that a cultural thing? I mean, is that just accepted as the way things are done in Britain?
I don't think people should think of it as unusual at all. It's so important that a charity like RNIB recognises that, yes, visually impaired people will want to read the information that RNIB puts out, but what about all of the other information out there? For example, everything from government information to online gambling to information about music, absolutely everything. RNIB recognises that it's blind people's right to be able to read whatever they want to, so we're working as hard as we can to make sure that that's possible.
I guess that some would say, though, that that should be the rightful role of an organisation of the blind, say a consumer group, as opposed to a service provider.
Well, we work together. We very much work together. The campaigning that I undertake to encourage people to design better websites isn't just done in isolation. It isn't me as an RNIB employee getting on with this on my own. I very much work with visually impaired people.
You issued a press release earlier in the week regarding inaccessible search engines in the UK. Well, perhaps not so much inaccessible, might be too strong a term, but at least search engines that were troublesome. That research came from an outside source, I understand.
That's right. That research wasn't actually performed by RNIB. It was undertaken by the University of Loughborough, which is slightly to the north of London in the UK. They undertook the research using a number of visually impaired students from a college that actually belongs to RNIB up in Loughborough. They undertook the research. They found that there were some issues with the accessibility of the search engines, not disasters, but just some things that made it a little bit more difficult to search than if you were a sighted person, for example. They did make search engines aware of the research. They did contact them, but received no response. So they got in touch with us at RNIB, and we agreed to make more of an issue of the matter because we feel it's important. So last Friday, we did issue a press statement about the research. I have to say that we did contact the search engines concerned beforehand to make them aware that the story was going to be hitting the press, but we didn't receive a response. But when it did receive some publicity on the Friday, it was very, very exciting to have Alta Vista actually get in contact with us pretty much straight away to say that they will make amends, that they're now aware of the problem, and they will try and make their search engine more accessible. So that's a real win for us.
Does the fact that you didn't get a response in the first instance, though, indicate that really people don't care about accessibility in the web design industry until they're embarrassed into doing something about it?
Well, I certainly hope that's not the case. In my general experience, it's ignorance. It's really people not thinking about visually impaired people at all. I think that this is a kind of a circular problem in that designers tend not to think about visually impaired people because they don't know any. They don't know any because there aren't very many visually impaired people in the workplace. There aren't visually impaired people in the workplace because they don't have the information that they need to apply for the jobs. It's a vicious cycle that we really need to tackle. But I think part of the problem also in the fact that we did contact the search engines and we didn't get a response is because they receive so much email from individuals. They just send out these standard responses. I'm not even sure that they really read through the kind of warning that I issued to them that we were going to the press with story, and maybe they've learned a lesson from that about listening to their customers. I hope so.
So what's specifically wrong with the search engines that the research highlighted?
Well, the main difficulties with advertising Now, we're not saying that advertising is a problem per se. In fact, we've found by talking to visually impaired people that they actually prefer to have the advertising on websites because it makes them aware of products that are available. Visually impaired people who don't have access to print or don't watch television tend to miss out on a lot of the advertising that sighted people are aware of. So we found that advertising in general is a good thing. However, it depends where the advertising is placed on a website. And with many of these search engines, you perform your search, you get a new screen up which has got the results of your search. But before you can actually get to the list of search results, you have to wade through sometimes minutes worth of advertising, which is a real problem when you're trying to use the search engine to find an urgent piece of information. So that was the main issue.
And the screen reader users or assistive technology users actually who participated in the study, were they experienced users or people who were just starting to use computers?
It was a variety. It was a variety. But it's a good question because you do find that people who, of course, are more experienced in using the web can really make light work of a lot of these more inaccessible designs. But at RNIB, we're always focusing on new users. In the UK, we have the advent of free internet access now. So very many visually impaired people who've never used the internet before are starting to get online. So we're expecting a high level of accessibility on the web to make sure that those people are able to use it effectively, not just those people who've been using it for a long time and really are experts.
Do you know what assistive technology was being used in the study?
It was a mixture of synthesized speech software and also screen magnification.
But was it one synthesized speech package in particular or a range of packages?
There was a range of packages being used, yes.
Okay. The reason for asking is that there has been considerable discussion as a result of this press release, which inevitably has been forwarded to email lists in the blind community, and really quite an outpouring of comments from people saying that that for them, these particular sites aren't a problem. How do you sort of reconcile that with the study findings?
Sure. I think for a lot of people who are very au fait with their own technology and are experienced internet users, which may account for some of the people that you've been hearing from, then maybe they're not a problem, and that's great. Certainly a lot of search engines and websites that anybody visits for the first time that can seem really complicated, the more you use them, the less of a problem they become. But we're really focusing on people, as I said a moment ago, who might be new entrants, who might be brand new to the internet, and it's all very confusing at first. And something that we're particularly looking for is for websites to adhere to the standards of the Web Accessibility Initiative, which are a very straightforward set of guidelines about using alternative text behind images, and the problem that I mentioned with advertising, constructing websites in a way that makes them easy to navigate. And all of these search engines certainly fell short of those guidelines.
So how do the RNIB go about determining whether a difficulty that a blind person might be having with a given site is actually due to poor or obsolete screen reading technology or insufficient training or a legitimate access issue?
Again, we really compare the site to the Web Accessibility Initiative guidelines. If you go to the W3C site, that's at w3.org, you'll find a link to the Web Accessibility Initiative. That's a project group of the World Wide Web Consortium, and they've produced a set of recommendations for the design of accessible websites, and RNIB advocates those guidelines. It's those guidelines that we recommend web designers use to ensure they're designing sites that are good for everybody. So it's a very simple matter to assess whether or not a site is accessible according to the guidelines. There's also a really helpful tool on the web that I'd advise everybody to start using, and it's called Bobby. If you go to www.cast.org/bobby, you'll find a web tool there which will check the accessibility of any website. You just type the address of the website into the box, hit the button, and straight away you receive a report back on the accessibility of the particular website as compared with the WAI's guidelines. Also with some advice on how to correct any of the accessibility problems. So I'd really recommend that to anybody who comes across a site and is wondering how accessible it is or how the problems may be put right.
We did a talk show a couple of weeks ago now where people phone in from around the world and discuss a range of issues. And what we found was that there appears to be an increasing number of blind people who are expressing a view that the WAI guidelines are actually too prescriptive and are causing an unnecessary backlash. Do you get any of that kind of feedback?
The important thing to remember with the way guidelines is that there are three levels of conformance, level one, level two, and level three. And those who reach level three have produced sites that really cover all the, meet all the recommendations that WAE put forward. I run my own website for people with multiple sclerosis, which is a condition that I have, and that meets level three. That meets the highest level of accessibility requirement, and it's no different to any other site out there in appearance. It wasn't a hugely difficult task to make the site accessible. I think the real enemy that we have is people's ignorance, not the complexity of the guidelines. I really don't.
Let me give you an example, though, of what some people are saying is actually the WAE guidelines not being able to keep up with emerging technologies, and see what your view is on this. One of the things that is mentioned in the WAE guidelines, and also I note in the Websites That Work video, is that tables should be avoided. And yet there are some with talking browsers or newer screen readers who actually really find it easier to use tabular information in say, pages like stock charts and things like that, and would be actually quite disadvantaged if their tables were taken away. So how do we reconcile those issues?
Well, what WAI is saying there is that tables really shouldn't be used to control presentation, that all HTML code should be used to control the structure of a page rather than the visual look of it. And where we run into problems with tables is when people who are coding the pages misuse them. That's really the problem. But the access technology has moved on. It used to be the case that if you were using tables to format text into columns, that some screen readers would read right across the page rather than down each column in the way that the eye reads. But that is now increasingly being overcome. However, in the UK, we still have a huge legacy problem where a lot of visually impaired people are using older screen readers for a variety of reasons that still can't deal with the table problem. So I would say the table problem is going away, so people who've said that are quite right, but there are still people who are using older access technology that can't deal with them so well, and we must think about those people too.
But are we actually apportioning the responsibility on the wrong people? In other words, if blind people are being prevented from making use of the new technologies that will enable greater independence and potential employability because maybe there isn't appropriate social assistance for them to get the latest and greatest screen reading technology, shouldn't we be putting the hard word on governments around the world rather than getting web designers to conform to outmoded assistive technology?
I think we should be doing that as well. I think this is a complex area and there's several levels at which it could be tackled. However, my experience of running this campaign is that it's ignorance that's a big problem, and that when you make designers aware, and we do that by inviting them to the Royal National Institute for the Blind to have a demonstration of the equipment, they are then converted. It's purely ignorance. It's not thinking that disabled people exist, or that they use computers, or heaven forbid that they use the internet. Explain to them that people do, that it's important to them. That goes a long, long way in convincing people about what they need to do. And let's remember, these people who are designing these websites, they're not just designing on the web. These people are moving on, doing other jobs, are designing the built environment. So it's really important to bridge the gap with them and to get them to understand that whatever they're designing, in whatever environment, they have to think inclusively.
Yes, and if you're successful in gaining their interest and genuinely wanting to do something about it, and then they find, for instance, that they're going to have to significantly redo their site. I mean, we haven't talked about JavaScript, for instance, which, again, is probably more of a legacy issue than an access issue, because there is some JavaScript that actually provides some really useful material, and yet the guidelines are saying avoid using JavaScript. So aren't we asking web designers unnecessarily, given the state of current technology, to turn their world upside down, and that will inevitably cause a backlash?
I don't think we are. Whenever we're speaking to designers, we never tell them to stop using the latest technology. We wouldn't get anywhere with an argument like that. What we say to them is, yes, by all means, use the latest technology, but bear in mind that there may be some people out there who can't access that yet. So what you need to do is make sure that that information is available to everybody. So if people are coming to your site and they can't use JavaScript because their access technology can't cope with it, then make sure that that core information is available to them somehow. So so that whenever anybody is coming to your site, whatever their disability, whatever their circumstance, they're coming away with the same information as people who are fully sighted, who are able-bodied, who have the latest technology. That's what's important.
And one way you have sought to do that is with the video websites that work. Can you tell us a bit about that and what the video contains and how it's available?
Yes, we produced the video and websites at work on behalf of WAY. We produced it as an education and outreach tool because we understand that the guidelines are quite complex if you're not really familiar with HTML. And let's face it, a lot of web designers aren't. They learn how to design websites by using a free CD-ROM that they picked up off the cover of a magazine that they bought at the local newsagents. They certainly haven't got any programming skills. So we produced this video to be a gentle introduction to accessible design and also to answer the questions that's on the lips of so many designers that I speak to, which is how on earth do disabled people use the internet? So the video is a 15-minute introduction to the issues, and it shows a variety of people with different disabilities using the internet with a variety of different software and hardware. And the video has been incredibly popular. We sent out about 10,000 copies of it from my office. It's also available on the web to be viewed that way. And people have come back to us and said, my goodness, we didn't realize that this was an issue at all. And now we're determined to do something about it.
One of the other angles, I suppose, that's important is actually looking at the HTML authoring tools so that eventually when somebody tries to put in a graphical link without an alt tag, you get a dialogue box that pops up with all sorts of bonging noises saying, hey, you haven't got an alt tag. Is that something that RNIB is working on as well?
It's something that WAI is. It's something that they're very aware of, is the importance of having tools that automatically do this so people aren't having to do retrospective conversion, which is irritating for everybody when you have that extra work to do. That's certainly another element of the campaign.
Can you give us some examples of some really accessible sites? I mean, I know, having visited RNIB's site many times, that it obviously takes great care to conform to these guidelines, but are there any others that you can mention where perhaps you've had a success that there was initially a very inaccessible site and after some advocacy it's turned out to be a model of accessibility?
Most certainly. I mean, let's take the whole of the United Kingdom government for starters. The government websites were notoriously inaccessible. The number 10 Downing Street, Tony Blair's website, our Prime Minister, absolutely notorious in its inaccessibility. However, we kept pressure on the government for a very long time, had a lot of meetings with them, and in November last year, I was invited to co-write the government's new website guidelines. As a consequence, there is now a lot of information about accessibility in the government's guidelines, and as a consequence of that, all UK central and local government websites and government agencies are now expected to be fully accessible to visually impaired people. So that was a massive win. Another exciting thing that's on the horizon, and it's definitely a big win for advocacy, we have a very large supermarket chain in the United Kingdom that's called Tesco. And again, the Tesco website, the online shopping site, was notoriously inaccessible to visually impaired people. So we encouraged visually impaired people to complain about this, and Tesco in fact received, I think it was about 40 individual complaints from visually impaired people who wanted to do their online shopping from home, but were unable to do so. As a result, Tesco got in contact with us, and we're about to start work on a fully accessible version of the Tesco online shopping service, which will mean visually impaired people can go onto the internet at home, can do their shopping, it will be delivered to their home, in fact to their kitchen, and that's even if they're on the 20th floor and the lift is broken. And there will also be extra time afforded so that the people delivering the goods can describe which is the cat food and which is the spaghetti bolognese, which seems to be quite a useful feature. We're about to start work with that on Tesco's, and it will be launched in the autumn, and quite possibly the first accessible superstore of its kind in the world. So that's very exciting. And that all came about because of us working together with visually impaired people, encouraging them to complain. It really does work. And I'd encourage visually impaired people who come across websites they can't use to complain and keep on complaining until you get what you want.
I suppose, though, that there's a right way to complain, isn't there? And I suppose you might have some views on this. If you kind of send someone off a terse letter, at least in the first instance, that may not achieve the right reaction. What sort of manner do you think people should adopt when they first draw to a web designer's attention that their site is a problem?
I think you must stress that you're a customer. And as a customer, you have a right to be able to use the website. But, I mean, as you say, don't be rude, but be assertive. Be absolutely assertive about it and say, I'm a customer of your company. I've come to your website because I wanted to browse and potentially buy your products, and I've been unable to do so. In fact, we have produced a couple of standard letters on our website that people can send to designers of websites that they find inaccessible. Of course, the big problem is that you go to a site that's inaccessible, and how can you find the address you need to write to complain, because the inaccessible design of the site prevents you from doing that. So what we encourage people to do is to contact us. In fact, they can contact me. If anybody comes across a site, they can't get into it and they're stuck, come to me, let me know what the site is. I will find the address and let's complain together. So then we've got the perspective of the customer and also RNIB putting some pressure on as well. And what I do is, if the organisation's within the UK, is I explain what the problem is in the technical details, if I'm in a position to do that, and invite the designers to come to RNIB for a demonstration of the technology so they can see exactly what the problem is, and that is an extremely enlightening experience for these designers. And then we can work on the way forward, how we're going to tackle the inaccessibility. Time and time again we've done this. As I say, we did this with Tesco's and we got a fantastic result.
What kind of impact is your disability discrimination having on this whole web accessibility thing?
At the moment, we don't know because there haven't been any test cases. It's as simple as that. It's not clear if the law states that accessible websites are a part or do come under the DDA. So at the moment, I'm afraid we just don't know. So we just keep pushing that it's a civil right that people are able to access, people with disabilities are able to access the same information on the web as everybody else.
So you'll be watching the NFB's lawsuit against AOL with considerable interest.
Yes, well, we're waiting to see, well, particularly in the UK, we're waiting to see what happens. We're waiting to see if somebody takes a case. Of course, we're always looking out for potential cases ourselves to take. But at the moment, we found it's ignorance. And when you approach people, they do something about it. I honestly have not had anybody I've approached say, oh, well, we're not interested in that and we're not going to do anything at all about it. So certainly the advocacy seems to be working at the moment. But also our work with government is key. We've convinced the government to provide guidelines to make sure that all government websites are accessible. It's not a great leap of faith to imagine those guidelines being extended to apply to everybody. So watch this space. We'll see what happens.
Okay. And just rounding this off, you have a couple of resources that we should tell people about. I'm not sure, is the URL for the websites that work one of those easy ones to remember, or should I just hunt it down and
it
put
is.
It on our page somewhere?
Yes, it is. It's www.rnib.org.uk/digital. If you go to that website address, you'll find information about our campaign and a link to information about the video websites that work.
Oh, that's excellent. And of course, that will also take people to the letters that you were talking about and all kinds of other useful information.
That's right, yes.
You have an email list, and I'm on that, and receive your very informative postings from time to time. How does that work? What's its purpose?
The purpose of that is really to give people information about our campaign. I'd like to send out the bulletins more frequently, but I have to say I'm very rarely in the office. Reason being, I do a lot of public speaking and campaigning work that takes me out to other organisations, and I make absolutely no apology for that, because that's how we do our work. But if people are interested to receive a bulletin from me from time to time to know what we're up to with our campaign, to know what the successes are, but more importantly to know how you can get involved and make a difference, then you'll find details about the list on the website address.